me, please? It's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack, to some welcome to 199th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to recordings of the previous 198 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts and entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try it and subscribe. It's free and only one email per day. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join us tonight, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, the live or as most do listens later. Next Sunday, my guest will be author Kate Hanson Foster. Now to this week's show, 199th, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is creative director of GYI MFA, Gabriella Pereira. I first came across Gabriella when reading the June 2017 issue of The Writer and found the feature article on GYI MFA. I put it on my list to get in touch with her, but had not until no more than a week later I read an interesting column by her on creativity in the September 2017 issue of the Writer's Digest. Obviously, fate wanted me to reach out to her now, so I did, and here she is. Good evening, Gabriella. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You've taken an interesting path to reach what seems to be what you belong doing. Let's go back to the history. Now, where'd you grow up and go to early school?
So I grew up in New York City, about 3 or 4 blocks away from where I live right now. I'm a city girl born and raised, and I went to elementary school at a Montessori school in our neighborhood, and then I went to one of those sort of posh, sort of weird private all-girl schools. It was sort of a traumatic experience in my life that I have sort of a love-hate relationship with, like, my high school years, but I think most people do. But anyway, that was in New York City as well. And that all of these things have sort of shaped my view on life and literature and work, et cetera.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
So when I was really, really little, I wanted to be a dentist because everyone in my family is dentists, except for my parents. But, like, I have a gajillion aunts and uncles who are all dentists, and my grandfather was a dentist. In fact, he was one of those, like, apprentice dentists in Brazil where, like, before they even had medical and dental school, he basically, like, apprenticed with a dentist and then rode a horse around the countryside dentisting, I guess, like, to the country people. And then eventually he went on to college and medical school. because back then you had to have a medical degree to be a dentist. So anyway, the dentist thing was really big in my family. And then I turned like four and I realized that I didn't really want to be a dentist because what if people had bad breath? So that kind of put a damper on my whole dentist aspirations. And then I decided pretty early on I wanted to be both an entrepreneur and a writer. So kind of in line with what I'm doing now.
Do you remember the first time you wrote anything?
So this actually ties to exactly when I realized I wanted to be a writer, which was in first grade. And I remember this moment very clearly because I was in the school library at this Montessori elementary school that I attended. And I was in the library. And back then, the library was broken up based on the different age groups, right? Like, so kindergarten section, first grade, second grade. And so me being kind of the, like, you know, presumptuous first grader that I was, I marched over to the fifth grade section and I pulled a book off the shelf. It was Lloyd Alexander's The Book of Three. And I still remember I pulled it off the shelf because it had this really cool cover with a picture of this guy with a skull head and antlers. And I thought, whoa, this is so cool. I have to read this book. So I started reading the book. And I realized that I could read the first page. And then surprisingly enough, I could finish the whole chapter. And then I realized that I could read the whole book. And so that's when the panic set in. And all of a sudden, I started having this meltdown in the middle of the library because it occurred to me that if I could read this book and I could read all the other Lloyd Alexander books, then I could read all the books in the fifth grade section, which means I could read all the books in the entire library, which meant that I could read all the books in the world because that's how my first grade mind worked. And then I'd run out of things to read and I would be bored forever. And I freaked out. And that's when, you know, the librarian noticed that I was having this meltdown and she told the first grade teacher. And so that's when the next day our teacher brought in this activity where we could write stories of our own and decorate a cover and do illustrations. And then we'd bind them together with a good old fashioned stapler. And then we'd put them in the book corner of our first grade classroom. And it would be like a real book that we could read at story time. And that's when it occurred to me that I could write books that I wanted to read. Like when I ran out of things to read, I could write something to fill those gaps. And that's where it all started.
Did you write for school paper or the literary journal or the yearbook while in either high school or later on?
So that it's interesting you ask that because after that wonderful, inspiring moment in first grade, I actually had some pretty big dips in like later elementary school and then in high school. I was put in remedial English in third grade because apparently back then having being bilingual was considered a learning disability at that hoity-toity school that I went to. So I had from then moved on from the Montessori school to the hoity-toity school. And so they put me in remedial English, which kind of put a damper on my love of writing because we were sort of forced to, you know, do all this mechanical, boring writing stuff. And so that kind of put a damper on things. And then in high school, like I just remember a lot of teachers criticizing things like my spelling. And I remember my response was always, but if spell check can fix it, why do I need to think about that? Like, isn't it more important for me to worry about the ideas? And so I never really got into the whole like school newspaper, school literary magazines. I did, however, have a lot of fun in high school messing with my history and English teacher. So like I kind of would purposely play these games where I try to write papers for my classes that completely contradicted whatever they were trying to like instill in our minds, but still made a cogent enough argument that they couldn't possibly give me a bad grade. And there was this one particular history teacher who was extraordinarily liberal. So I purposefully wrote all these very uber conservative papers, which I totally didn't agree with, but I wrote them just to needle her. And that was actually the moment that I realized that you could write things that you don't necessarily agree with, as long as the argument is coherent and that you can state your case appropriately. So that was actually a big eye-opening experience for my writing as well. But I never really got into sort of the formalized writing environment. I think I was way too much of a troublemaker.
That's very interesting now, if you notice, because the great conservative writers of the last 20 years who wrote very well, and to me they were a pleasure to read, if I disagreed with them, like George Will, William F. Buckley Jr., they've been replaced by a whole bunch of the people namely television people now, who just don't present articles well, and we demean conservatives by even calling them conservatives, or by calling our president a conservative, I think. You know, so I think that's unfortunate. We used to have this debate between brilliant liberals and brilliant conservatives, and now we don't have it because many of the well-known conservatives, writers like George Will and David Brooks and David Frum and Michael Gerson, they've all bailed out on Trump, and they're on the other side now. So it's, we don't have the discourse.
Yeah. You know, and for me, it's interesting because, like, that was an experience that was very eye-opening in that it taught me that it wasn't about your ideology. It was about how coherent your argument was. And I actually still have almost all of the English papers that I, or history papers that I got from this history teacher, because she'd write these comments on them, basically saying how she absolutely unilaterally disagreed with everything I wrote. And she suspected that I didn't necessarily agree with a lot of the things I was saying either, but that it was a coherent argument. And that to me was in some ways more encouraging than if I had just, you know, checked the right boxes and written what the teacher had expected. Granted, I think I was very lucky to have a teacher who sort of understood that I was playing this game and testing this out with her. And so she gave me that free rein. I feel like a lot of kids in high school are basically taught to do what the teacher expects. Like, they're taught to regurgitate whatever it is that their teacher wants from them, and that in a sense does them a disservice because they never learn to think for themselves and actually formulate those arguments.
Now, you mentioned bilingual. Was it Portuguese?
Yes, it was. My parents are both immigrants from Brazil. My mom is the one whose dad was the dentist, and my dad also is from Brazil.
Now, did you retain the language?
I do. I'm fully bilingual. In fact, I have this weird thing where I write better in English than I do in Portuguese, because I basically, my grasp of Portuguese grammar and reading and writing is about what you would learn if you were kind of learning it on your own up until about elementary school. But then, because I never had the formal high school schooling, or like middle school, say, but I never had that high school schooling, so I never read like the literature of, you know, Portugal and Brazil. And so it kind of capped out at that level. But it's weird because in some ways, like, in terms of fluency, I'm basically 100% fluent in both. And depending on what I'm talking about, it's actually easier for me to either speak in Portuguese or English, depending on the topic.
Now, are you also then part of the Portuguese community where you can speak to other people in their native language?
Absolutely. I mean, my parents and I talk to them almost exclusively in Portuguese. With my siblings, it's more you know, give or take. Like, it kind of depends again on like what our topic is. My sister and I went to the same hoity-toity school, so people always kind of knew that we, like, when we'd automatically switch to Portuguese, they were like, oh, she's talking about somebody. And so it kind of became this like joke at school. But yeah, I mean, growing up, like, we had all of these aunts and uncles who were not actually biologically related to us. They were simply other displaced Brazilian families who had kids about the same age as us, and they were all friends. Like, the parents were all friends and the kids were all friends. We still refer to them as like aunts, uncles, and cousins, like, even though we're not related. But, you know, it's sort of the community that we grew up in.
Now, being bilingual and being fluent in both, why did the school determine that you need remedial English? That doesn't make much sense to me.
I know. It was the 80s, and they were just dumb. Like, it's funny. Like, looking back on it now, I realize, like, it was so the prejudice of the times that, like, the school literally thought that they were doing the best thing by putting both myself and my younger sister in this, like, remedial English class. But then, it's interestingly enough, like, when my sister and I were both, we reached high school, the elementary school teacher, the one who, like, or the elementary school head who, like, moved us, forced us to do this, like, extra class or special class, she actually formally apologized to my parents and to us, because this research came out sometime in, like, the 90s showing that being bilingual actually is not something that could be detrimental to a student's development. It's actually a positive thing. You know, surprise, surprise, to us looking back now, it's like, seems obvious, but I guess at the time people were worried that if you had two languages, that it might somehow lessen your grasp of the English language. So anyway, this teacher formally apologized to my parents and to us. And so, like, you know, bygones are bygones. But it's still sort of funny looking back that, like, as a writer, I was thrown into remedial English. Like, how hilarious is that?
And then you're off to college. Where and to study what?
So I went to Williams College, which is a small liberal arts school in northwestern Massachusetts. The running joke in my family, and this might sound sort of presumptuous, but it was sort of like this joke, like my parents had very high expectations of me. So the joke, what my sister and my younger brother always said is that Harvard was my safety school. It wasn't my safety school. I didn't apply to Harvard, but it was sort of this thing, like our parents always had, you know, typical immigrant family, your expectations are super high. I rebelled against that, of course, by going to a small liberal arts school, which is a very respectable school, but not Harvard. And so and I went there and I didn't really know what to study because I wanted to study everything. And I still remember my freshman year, I did very well in my classes. And I remember I'd had an advisor who had cautioned me against taking too difficult of a course load. She's like, you know, you're coming in, you're a freshman, you know, take it easy, blah, blah, blah. So I followed her instructions and I coasted through my first semester and I was bored out of my mind. And I was furious because I got like, I walked into her office during our winter term or our winter break. And I like march in there and I like throw my transcript on her desk and I'm like, look at this, it's unacceptable. And she's like, what are you talking about? You got straight A's. And I'm like, because I didn't have to work for these. Like, I should have to suffer to get grades this good. And so she's like, at that moment, I think she was like, all right, what do we need to do to make this not be an issue anymore? And so from then on, I basically just took all the classes and studied all the things, which was super fun. And at that point, I was very happy. I ended up being an English psychology double major. I almost math majored, but I decided not to my senior year because a triple major would have been insane. And also because I figured as an English and a psychology major, you had to be a major to take all of the really cool classes, like the really hard ones. But as a math major, no one in their right mind would take like applied topology or abstract algebra just for kicks, except for me, because I was the crazy person. So like, I figured if I didn't declare a math major, they'd still let me into all those classes because they wouldn't be full. And I was right. So in the end, I got to take all the classes I wanted and I had a really good time.
My wife was the math major at Penn State and she liked topology as I remember.
It's awesome. My favorite was abstract algebra, though. Like, I had so much fun, and at one point, my abstract algebra professor, who I'm still in touch with, by the way, because she's amazing, she would give us these crazy extra credit assignments, and at one point, one of the extra credit assignments was to think about algebra in a way that was not algebraic. So I decided to write a parody of the poem 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, by Robert Stevens, but I did it as 13 Ways of Looking at a Matrix. And it was hilarious and super fun and like the kind of nerdy stuff that I totally would have done in college.
Did you write the publication in college, either for real publication or for the college, anything? Paper, yearbook?
I'm trying to think. I don't think I did. I'm looking back now. I really didn't. Most of the writing I did was either like assignments or that sort of thing. I really only started writing thinking that I would be published well after college, like once I was in the thick of DIY MFA.
So had you lost the desire to be a writer and an entrepreneur by this time?
No, I think what happened was I got a little sidetracked. See, I thought the entrepreneur piece was pulling at me more than the writer piece. And the entrepreneur piece, what I really wanted to do when I was in college was be a toy designer. And I had this idea that I was going to work in the toy industry for a while, and then I would start my own toy company. And it probably seems like it's a complete like polar opposite of what I'm doing now. But really, in terms of like the way my brain exercises, it's sort of the same thing. Like the way you build a toy is kind of the same way that you build an article or you build a writing course. So it's kind of the same thought process. It's just applied in a different direction. And at that time, so I had these aspirations to be a toy designer. And I remember going to like the career services center, like the career counseling center. And, you know, they were very used to people who wanted to be consultants or work in finance or do Teach for America, you know, sort of the typical things. So I walk in there and I'm like, I want to be a toy designer. And the blank stares, it was like deer in headlights, like no one knew what to do with me. So that it just trying to figure out a way to make that happen took a while.
But after college, you didn't follow that directly, do enough for masses. Tell us about that.
So after college, I figured that the way to get into the toy industry would be through the psychology route. So I went on and got a master's at Cornell. I was actually PhD track, and I was doing developmental psychology. And specifically, the research I wanted to do was look at how the design, like the physical design of toys and children's products would affect their play behaviors. And I had this whole plan, master plan on how I was going to do it. And I cobbled together a committee of advisors that spanned both the design department and the developmental psychology department, and also the statistics, because I was a math nerd. So I like sort of cobbled together this committee of people. And it was really fun. And then I hit my second year, and I realized that doing the PhD was just going to be the same thing. Like I'd basically be just be doing my master's thesis again, like multiple times to do the dissertation. And that's when I realized, okay, I'm done with that. So I gracefully exited and came back to New York City. The great thing though about doing the PhD but then defecting with the master's is that you basically get a fully funded master's degree, which is kind of awesome.
And then doing off on slightly a different bent that I'm understanding now because of your toy design interest. I went to Parsons for a certificate in graphic design. Tell us about that.
So when I got back to New York again, I still wanted to do the toy thing, but I needed a portfolio because I'd gone and done the psychology thing. I hadn't really built up a portfolio of design work. And oddly enough, even though the toy industry, really the skill sets that are necessary when you are in the higher rungs of the design department is much more sort of psychology and business-based skill set, what you need at the entry level is purely design-based, or at least that's what I understood as an outsider looking into the industry. So I realized I needed a portfolio. So I got a certificate at Parsons, and at the same time I was applying for jobs, and I eventually got an internship that eventually turned into a job at a wonderful specialty toy company just outside of New York City. And so I worked there for a couple of years, and it was great fun. I got to design and develop products that spanned all different categories. I designed, musical instruments you play in the bathtub, and spy kits, and preschool toys, and a little bit of arts and crafts, but I wasn't like super into the arts and crafts stuff, and then like the gross motor stuff. So it was really fun. I had maybe 100, 150 products under my belt that I got to like, you know, shepherd from the idea stage all the way to when I got to hand it off to the sales team. And then, you know, it's kind of like being a babysitter. Like you start with this itty bitty baby idea, and then you grow it all the way until it's this full grown product that you can hold in your hands, and then you send it out into the world, and, you know, I can get all misty eyed.
And then though, you moved into the literary world with the literary management company. What brought on the change of direction?
So at that point, so in 2007 was sort of the pivotal year, right? And at that point, I had been working in the toy industry and I'd done a good job and I'd had a lot of fun, but I realized for a number of reasons that I needed to find a different alternative. Part of it was a reprise of the same theme, right? Like I'd get to a place where things would feel the same to me, and then I'd need to change things up. And the only way I knew how to do that was to change to a new environment. So just like in college, where I'd gotten bored with stuff and I'd changed something else, or, you know, working in like the master's degree, I'd kind of felt like I'd capped out what I could do. And so that was one piece of it. The other piece of it was a pragmatic side. So right around the early 2000s, so like right around when I was in the toy company, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. which is not some horrible, you know, thing that could end my life as I know it. But it did start to put a damper on things, in particular with the fact that I had to commute by car. And the only medicine that I could take was medicine that would affect my ability to drive a car. So I've basically spent a few years not being properly medicated because I had to be able to commute and I didn't feel comfortable or safe driving, you know, heavy machinery and taking medicine that I needed. And, you know, it's the unfortunate reality when you have a chronic illness and you need to take medication, sometimes it's going to put a damper on which jobs you can take. So I realized that there was no way for me to commute to this company. There's like the bus would have taken 3 hours each way. It was crazy. So there was no public transit. The only way to do it was to drive. And so I had to, at one point, I realized, like, this is not sustainable for the rest of my life. This is maybe sustainable to the end of a product cycle. So I brought my products all to their, you know, handed them to the sales team. Everything was tied up in a neat bow. And that's when I realized I needed to find something new. So that was right around the new year of 2007. And so at that point, I realized I needed to do something with myself that would be in New York City, like in the island of Manhattan or within, you know, commutable distance of New York. So the closer, the better, obviously. And then also something that I needed to do something where I wouldn't get bored and change gears in like, you know, a year. So I decided I was going to give this writing thing a try. And I was at a writing conference later that spring. That's where I met my now agent, but at the time he was my soon-to-be boss, so Jeff Kleinman of Folier Literary. And I met him there, and he had gave this really awesome presentation. And I realized as I was watching him speak, I want to work for this guy. And so I went home after that conference and like Googled the agency and realized that they were looking for interns. So I applied and they said yes. So I worked for them for, I think it was 3 or 4 months as an intern. And I figured that was also a way to get to know the industry and sort of a crash course and learn everything that I needed to know. I mean, I didn't know anything about publishing. I didn't know like what a query letter was or how the publishing industry worked. So it was a very much an eye-opening experience because I got to see things like at a ground, like on the ground level. And then from there, I realized that while I did love working with Jeff, I did not like the idea of becoming an agent because I think as a creative person, if I had been on the rejecter side, like if I had been the one receiving query letters and having to reject people, that would crush my soul. So I knew I didn't have it in me to do that. So I realized that like I needed to find something else, like another way to be part of this writing and publishing universe. And eventually that led me to the MFA program, which brings me here.
Which was the New School, which is also part of the New School University, as was Parsons. So it was almost like coming home, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, it's funny. The New School isn't like the departments don't really talk to each other. So it was almost like a different school. Like even though the buildings were like across the street from each other that I went to for the design classes versus the writing classes, it almost felt like a different world because they're like all the individual pockets of the New School tend to operate pretty separately from each other. So it was very interesting in that sense.
But years ago, I taught in the computer center at the New School, and we had students who were learning how to do things in the early days of word processing and things like that. So we had the business type looking types. We also had some computer science types, and we also had the artist from Parsons with the pink hair and everything like this. It was a very interesting mix of a student base. So tell us about the MFA program at the New School.
So, I mean, that it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And so I did an MFA in writing for children, and that was partially the reason I went to the New School specifically, because it's one of the few writing for children or one of the few MFA programs that offer writing for children as one of these subdivisions. Like most MFA programs, it's fiction, poetry, maybe nonfiction, and that's it. So that was a huge draw for me in terms of the new school. And it's interesting, like a lot of times when I, you know, when people ask me about DIY MFA, the next question usually is, well, didn't you like the new school? Like, didn't you have a good experience? And I'm like, yes, exactly. That's why I started DIY MFA, because for me, it was almost a way to continue that experience post-graduation. So yeah, it was a great experience. I studied with some amazing teachers. Hetty Jones was one of my workshop teachers, and she's just amazing. And David Levithan, like, he taught us teen literature and middle grade literature. I mean, can you imagine learning about teen literature from David Levithan? That's like, you know, mind blowing to me. So it was awesome.
So what attracted you to that particular audience, to the younger reader audience, rather than those to read Stephen King or James Patterson or the older audiences?
A few reasons. One ties back to the whole toy design thing. I figured, like, I'd been immersed in this world of, like, children and stuff for children for a long time. So I figured, like, for me, it was very familiar territory. It was, you know, it kind of went in line with what I'd been doing before. The other part of it, I think, is that I'm kind of an 11-year-old who never quite grew up. So part of me is, like, my brain still functions like an 11-year-old. Take that as you will. So for me, it's like, it's always been the part of literature that I enjoy reading the most. And it's sort of bizarre now, because in DIY MFA, I have to read more broadly, which is good. It stretches me to a certain degree, but it also means that, like, you know, I was basically going where things felt comfortable, where things felt familiar. At the same time, though, if you think about it, children's literature is among the most challenging to master because it's so tight and so compressed. So there's no room for error in there, kind of like poetry, right? Like, there's no wiggle room. You can't just pile on the fluff. And I think part of me, the piece of me that likes a challenge, that was attracted to that I wanted to go for something that was going to be, you know, have these rules around it that was going to make it more challenging.
It's interesting. I belong to the writers group in Upper Westchester, and two of the people there write for younger children. Both, I believe, definitely one is a school teacher, and he was a wrestling coach, and he got to know children fairly intimately that way. Another one writes for very young children, talking about turtles talking to birds and everything. And I haven't talked to anyone that came out of a different background that wasn't a teacher before. Have you found many people in the subgenre who are like you, who just decided that they were going to get into this?
Well, I mean, to a certain degree, I feel like in a way I was kind of in that same space, right? Because I'd been designing toys, I'd been studying child behavior. So in many ways, I was immersed in the world of kid.
Okay.
And I definitely find that a lot of, like, when I've gone to, you know, conferences like the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators conferences, it's a higher percentage than, say, at a regular conference, of those writers are going to be teachers or parents or, you know, educators of some sort, in part because, you know, they come to children's literature as adults because they now have children in their lives as either their students or their kids who kind of bring them back to that. For me, it was also the I just never quite grew up thing. So I was kind of always in that world because I think my brain just sort of stayed in that world since I was, you know, in middle school.
And then after graduation, you led workshops and you taught while at the same time founding a DIY MFA. First, tell us about the teaching, the workshops, and then I'll go deeply into your company.
So with the workshops, really, in a way, was sort of like different beta tests trying to figure out the DIY MFA thing and what exactly this DIY MFA thing was going to be. Because in the beginning, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know whether it was just an experiment or whether it could be a company. At one point, I thought it was a book before I thought it was a company. And then I sort of flipped the script on that. So the workshops kind of stemmed from the fact that I'd been in school for 2 years. I had not been working since while I was in school. And you know, I had left my job in end of 2006, beginning 2007. So at this point, I was like, all right, I kind of need to be working again. And while, you know, I'm married, my husband at the time was working at a big fancy law firm. So it's not like, you know, he wasn't pressuring me or anything, but some of it was coming from me. I felt like I need to be doing something. I need to start pulling my weight around here. So I started trying to do this grassroots thing where I'd build these workshops up. And it started out like just in a church basement where I'd, you know, advertise in the community in, you know, New York and the like Yorkville Upper East Side neighborhood. And I'd put up flyers and, you know, every semester, sometimes a lot of people would show up, sometimes not as many people would show up. And it was very sort of grassroots in that way. But on one hand, what was great about it was that it meant that I was in the trenches really getting a feel for who writers were and who was coming to writing, like who wanted this kind of instruction. So I learned a lot, and that's where I built up a lot of my teaching chops, where I started developing a lot of my methods and sort of techniques and whatnot. And then, so that's where it started. And then as DIY MFA started building up momentum online, I realized that clearly while New York City is a big city, I would have much broader reach if I focused my marketing and also my teaching to the online sectors. So that's kind of where that shift happened. And about a year or two after that, I stopped teaching live. And I started just focusing on the online stuff. And I did a lot of other experiments too. Like I'd partner with different groups. Like there was a group out in Brooklyn that I taught workshops for, 826 NYC, which is part of the 826 conglomerate. And, you know, the group run by Dave Eggers out in, or founded by Dave Eggers, and they,
okay,
it's kind of a cool thing, like working with kids and getting them excited about writing. So I did a lot of like volunteering and teaching for different groups just to kind of get a feel for how to do this. Cause I never actually was taught, like I never studied pedagogy. So I was kind of learning it as I went.
As in the side, I was happy to hear you say Yorkville as well as the Upper East Side. My father grew up in the first elevated department house in Yorkville. He and the young Robert Wagner, who later went on to be mayor, grew up in the same department house. Wagner's father was the senator from New York at the time. So
you know, I always make a point of saying, like, when people ask me, like, where do you live or where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Yorkville. And then usually I get the blank stare and people are like, huh? And I'm like, it's east of the Upper East Side. And then again, I get the blank stare and they're like, wait, what? Because like you can see the wheels turning. They're picturing the Upper East Side and they can't quite picture what would be east of that except for a body of water. And then I explain to them, no, it's like, you know, east of Second Avenue, that little slice of the Upper East Side. And then, but it's the way I sort of summarize it is it's the down to earth part of the Upper East Side. And it's a very different vibe as a neighborhood than what most people think of as the Upper East Side.
I've said earlier that you were where you seem to belong. I've said that partially because in going through your biographic material, I noted that you've spent more years with the firm you created than all the time that you spent after college in both postgraduate work and in various jobs. So it would have to be the labor of love. What led you to conceive and to found DIY MFA?
I love sharing this story because I think of it, you know, like how superheroes have an origin story. Not that I'm a superhero, but this is my origin story. So it started in a rickety church in the West Village, and it was graduation day. And I'm sitting there in this really stiff wooden pew watching the light stream in through the stained glass windows as some professor is live tweeting his, you know, from the media department, live tweeting his commencement talk from the podium. And I all of a sudden expect the skies to part and angel choirs to sing from on high, and the literary gods would then anoint me as a writer. And of course, that's exactly what didn't happen. Instead, I had this crazy idea, which was, what if I could have just done this all myself? And again, I want to emphasize that I had a wonderful experience, but I was also weighing that wonderful experience against the fact that I knew that I was in a privileged position. I knew that I could afford to take time off from school or from work to go to school, that I didn't have kids at the time, so I didn't have to worry about whether paying for a master's degree meant taking money away from my kids' college tuition, right? And recognizing that had I been at any other stage in my life, I probably wouldn't have been able to do what I had just done. And I had a lot of friends who were writers, who friends from writing groups or writing conferences at that point. I mean, going to a lot of conferences, who were kind of jealous. Like, they kept coming to me being like, oh, you're so lucky. You can go get an MFA. I could never do that because I can't afford it. I can't take time off my job. All those reasons, right? So I had this crazy idea. What if there was a way to do this yourself? What if I could teach other people? Now that I'd been on the inside and I'd gotten all that insider knowledge, what if I could teach people how to cobble together a DIY version of an MFA? So I went home and I did what any normal writer does when they have a question they need to figure out. I decided to write about it. And at the time, I had a blog and I had all of 12 followers. It was teeny tiny, 12 followers, one of whom was my mother. And so I sat down and I wrote a blog post about how to DIY your MFA. And I ended the post saying, if something like this existed, would you do it? And I half expected or fully expected that this post was going to go out into the ether and that all of a sudden, that no one else, I would never hear about this ever again. And this idea would peter out and nothing would come of it. The next day I wake up and I realize that I have something like 20 comments on that post. And I have like 5 or 6 emails in my inbox about that post. And I suddenly realized, and given that I had 12 followers, one of whom was my mother, I certainly didn't expect that kind of response, right? So at that moment, I realized that I'd hit a nerve. I'd hit something that clearly there was a need for. So the rest of that has really been just a big experiment, trying to figure out, okay, if there is a way to DIY an MFA, what does it look like? How would one put that together? And it was very much the same kind of experimental grassroots project and process that I'd done teaching those workshops, only it was now around this idea of DIY MFA. So at one point, I decided to experiment by blogging about this concept every single month, every single day for the month of September. And part of this experiment, there were two reasons I did this. First, I wanted to see if I could find enough things to say on this topic for every single day for a month. I figured by the end of 30 days, I would either have run out of things to say or I would have so many additional things to say that I could continue talking about this topic ad nauseum. And clearly the latter is what has happened. The other thing I figured during that experiment I anticipated would happen is either I was going to drive people crazy because they couldn't stand to hear me talk about DIY MFA again, or I would find more people who were equally passionate about it and interested in it and wanted to hear about it, and that my audience would grow. And what ended up happening by the end of that month is I went from having about, 12 followers, one of whom was my mother, to having about 400. And that was the moment when I realized, all right, clearly there's something to this now. And then, figuring out, okay, how are we going to actually turn this into something real that's not just an idea on a blog? And that's been the adventure for the last 7 years or so.
How did you conceive the program? What were you going to offer to people? How are you going to charge them? How are you going to deliver it? All these different things that come into a business idea.
So again, it was very much an organic process and it was very much an experimental process. So in the beginning, I thought this was a book. I didn't actually think it was a business. And I took a class because I figured I was going to have to write a book. I needed a platform. So I needed to build an audience. So I took a class on how to build your platform. And I remember the first, community, like it was one of those digital classes where you had like conference calls, like weekly conference calls. And we're on the conference call and I tell the teacher what my idea was, what my topic was, and that this was, I hoped this would become a book someday. And there's this like pause. And then suddenly the teacher says to me, and I still remember, he says, Gabriella, I don't think that's a book. And then of course my heart drops and I'm like, oh my God. And he says, no, I think that's a business. It's bigger than a book. And that was the moment, like that planted the seed when I realized like, oh, okay, this is actually, like I was thinking too small. And then I started thinking like, okay, how do I make a business from this. And, it, you know, it, again, it was experiments. The first product I offered flopped. I didn't fill the seats in this class, or I filled it, but it was very small. And it wouldn't have been viable had I done that, you know, long term. But it was an experiment. It helped me figure out, like, the first class I ever offered was actually a speaker series where I curated a lineup of, I think, 14 phenomenal speakers. I'm still, like, my mind is still boggled by the fact that these incredible people who I now count as colleagues at the time were people who I, like, looked at from afar and thought were, like, my heroes. And yet they agreed to participate in the speaker series with me, a nobody at the time. But, you know, it taught me a lot of things about nurturing the guests that I bring into my programs by nurturing my audience. It taught me a lot about sort of building products in ways that I can control things. I learned from that I really wanted to make my products things that I could fully control, and that the guest materials would always be additional bonuses, because you can't promise something if it's someone else who has to deliver it. But if it's all coming from me, then I knew I could very solidly promise my audience, yes, this is going, you will get this by the end of the course. So I learned a lot. Like, I beat my head against the wall at times. There were times when I thought, I can't do this anymore. What was I thinking? And then eventually, you know, I'd course correct and try something new. And eventually I found the system that is now the DIY MFA model, where we have a few flagship courses that we open periodically throughout the year, and that brings in a lot of our revenue, along with a lot of my speaking engagements and other sort of side revenue streams.
All right, so you have the core courses. Then how does it relate after that? Because I know you also have podcasts, then you have the blog and a few other things. How does it all tie together?
So the blog and the podcast are pieces. Well, the blog is something that now I actually very rarely appear on, oddly enough. I've learned over the years that my sort of that contact with me, because I'm sort of the person behind the business, or the business and I are sort of the same, that really that is something that has to be at a higher premium. So the blog has become much more of a space where I can then curate really great columnists who write for our site regularly. And my participation is much more sporadic. I will occasionally write a blog post here and there, but it's always very sort of pre-planned, and it's something that's kind of spaced out because I need to save my bandwidth for things like courses and whatnot. With the podcast, that was a different beast. And the other thing too with the blog is, you know, when I was first starting out, one of the best things was having people who were well-established bloggers allow me to step in front of their audience and, you know, write a guest post for them or something like that. And you sort of have that safety net of being able to create something in front of someone else's platform, but like they're still kind of hovering and watching. And so you know that like you can't quite fall on your face because they're, you know, they're not going to let something out in front of their audience if you're going to embarrass yourself. And so having had that experience and having had these people who were sort of like mentors, I wanted to offer that. So it's sort of a win-win, right? For me, we get this amazing arsenal of columnists. I think now we have something like 16 or 17 regular writers for the site. And yet for them, it's also good because they have that safety net. They know that we're going to help them put their best foot forward. So it becomes sort of a symbiotic relationship. For the podcast, it was a different beast. The podcast, I wanted to recreate what I had done but had flopped with the speaker series, but do it in a way that would basically allow me to have great conversations with my literary heroes. And I knew that, like, if I pick up the phone and I call up, you know, Delia Ephron and say, hey, like, not that I even know her phone number, but like I would never be able to just pick up the phone and be like, hey, let's talk literature. But if I have a podcast and if I have a big listenership, well, maybe somebody like that might be interested in coming on my show. So for me, it was kind of a selfish reason. I started the podcast in part because I kind of just wanted this opportunity to have conversations with people that I absolutely love their work or love what they stand for or love, you know, what they do. And I kind of needed a venue to facilitate that. So that's where the podcast came from.
Very similar to what I do with this radio show.
Exactly.
Reach out to people who I want to talk to. You also mentioned the core courses. What are the core courses, and then how does that work?
So we have, at the moment, we have two flagship courses. One of them is the DIY MFA 101. That course has actually been on hiatus for about a year because we are rebuilding it from scratch. When I wrote the book, so eventually I finally came to writing a DIY MFA book for Writer's Digest. And I realized after I wrote that book that everything I'd put in the course kind of needed a facelift. Like I hammered out a lot of my ideas in the process of writing this book and also in the process of editing it and having a really good editor help me to refine some of those concepts. So, and also over the years, the more I write articles for magazines, I kind of refine different ideas as I put them into articles. So it becomes this iterative process, and I realized that the 101 course that I had built back in 2014 had needed a bit of an upgrade. So we've been rebuilding it for the last year, and it's hopefully due out sometime in the fall. I'm shooting for October, fingers crossed. The other one is one that I realized I wanted to build last year, and it's called Pixels to Platform. And it's a course that helps writers and creative people develop an audience. And the way I like to explain the Pixels to Platform approach is it's kind of like building a tower with Jenga bricks. Most people, when they want to build an audience, they start with the bricks. They attack the bricks in the middle of the tower. And the problem with that is that if you're trying to build a foundation, like a strong tower, and you're making the strongest part the middle and not the base of the tower, that's the whole thing's going to implode and cave in. So what's important is sort of building that foundation, building that understanding of who your audience is, what your brand is, how you want to present yourself to your audience. And it's all, the whole approach is very iterative. So it's about trying things and making mistakes and then learning from those mistakes and trying it and making it better, which is kind of the way I built my platform and the way I've basically done everything I've done with DIY MFA. So it's become this, I sort of looked at what I had done and then also what I had observed other successful people who've built platforms, grassroots platforms, and then figured out, okay, what's the system behind that? And then built that system and put it into a course.
Now, how does this specific course work? Are there fixed meetings? Are there sections? Are there different teachers? How does that particular course work?
So the way the DIY MFA flagship courses have worked, the best way I found is to pre-record everything, and they're recorded as videos, and they're available in a locked site where people have like a login. And the content, with the help of some techie magicians, we've figured out a way to make it so that everything's very seamless and automated. So like you sign up, and then the first week of the course, you'll get an email saying, here's your first lesson, and you go there, and there's a video or two videos or three videos, however many, and you watch the videos, and then there are like companion worksheets that you download with them, and you can do them to implement the concepts from the videos. And the idea behind this, and I tried teaching live, I tried teaching like with the speaker series, we had the sessions were actually live and people could ask questions during the class. And what I realized is that these systems are great, but they're not scalable. Like in the long term, it's easy to do that if you've got 20 or 30 students in a class. But if you have 100, or if you're trying to run a class and people are joining at different stages or different weeks, that can become very difficult and very complicated. So what I've landed on that works really well is that we open the course periodically throughout the year so that a big group of people will kind of come in together at the same time. And that way they have a cohort or a little community together. And we have a Facebook group or some other ways of connecting online, like conference calls and whatnot, so that at least people have the sense of the camaraderie of the classroom, but they also have the access to be able to watch the videos, do the lessons, do the homework, as it were, but on their own time. And, you know, if you want to log in at 3 o'clock in the morning, that is totally fine. This has also facilitated things so that we can have people in very different time zones in the same class. So like I've had people in like China and then people in, you know, New York City taking the same class and being able to participate and interact with each other without actually having the time zone become an issue.
If you have people in New York, do they get to know each other well enough that they might have some some face-to-face contact to discuss things, or is it fairly anonymous?
At this, I mean, it's certainly not anonymous in the sense that people are connecting online, and generally at the moment we've been doing most of the online connection through Facebook groups, although sort of we've been playing with, like me and the techie magicians, we're working on building some more of an interactive space within the course website, but that is still a piece that's very much in progress. So at the moment we're kind of relying on private closed Facebook groups for that like interaction, but we've certainly had people become very good friends in the course. In fact, the Writer's Digest conference is happening, I think, in 2 weeks here in New York City. And I want to say, like, there's probably going to be at least 10, 15, 20 people between DIY MFA team members, members, active members of the Word Nerd subscribership, you know, sort of like the newsletter subscribership, and course, you know, class students, like former students, alumni. The other thing of it too is I learned early on that it's important for the alumni to stay engaged. So people who take the course continue to have access indefinitely. And until the course becomes unmanageable, they will also still have access to the, you know, online community and to the conference calls. And I find that that allows the newer students to get to know some of the students who've been through the class maybe a semester ago or a year ago. And they kind of all are in it together, and that those different levels of experience, like the ones who are a little further ahead, help to sort of pull up the ones that are just getting started. So it creates this great environment online.
Obviously, the completion of the college or university-based MFAs result in the resume item. What does the DIY MFA provide that for some would be more useful than a resume item?
So you definitely don't get a line on the, or you don't get a degree. Let's put it that way. You don't get a shiny piece of paper. In fact, it's almost like DIY MFA. It's not that we're against the shiny piece of paper. We just recognize that it is certainly not necessary in order to be a writer. What I have found, though, is a lot of writers who do the DIY MFA course, like now as DIY MFA is building up credibility in the publishing world, like publishers know us. Agents know us. People, when people start putting that in a query letter, like, hey, I completed this course, it's beginning to carry weight to a certain degree. And people have a community, and they also have a system that becomes sustainable long term. The problem with an MFA program, a traditional program, is that it ends. Like, you get to graduation day and then it's over. And if you want to continue any of that, you have to figure out a way to do that. I mean, that's sort of one of the reasons why I started DIY MFA, is because I kind of wanted to maintain some, I want to keep my hand in the game, as it were. Whereas with DIY MFA, you're always part of that community if you'd like to be. And so then you can build different pieces of that community and into of the DIY MFA sort of philosophy into your writing life indefinitely. And the part of the other thing with DIY MFA is that it's, we kind of acknowledge that evolution is a natural part of being a writer. So it's all about learning how to evolve and grow as a writer, and then how to make shifts in your process and in your, you know, your DIY MFA. Like for me, what I was doing in my own personal DIY MFA back in 2010, when I founded the program, is very different from what I'm doing now. And yet the philosophy still applies, because you can kind of, it kind of bakes evolution into the whole thing.
Now, you mentioned the core course. Well, I'd imagine that in a university MFA, that should have the choice if you were a poet or a novelist or a magazine writer. How do you bring all those interests together into one course?
So DIY MFA, to a certain degree, so the foundation course 101, it's something of a meta program, right? Like on one hand, we do focus very deeply on the craft of writing, but it's looking also at the process. And so the way DIY MFA breaks down, we have the three pillars, which if you go on our website, you'll see the three pillars are very clearly plastered all over the place. There's write with focus is one of them, read with purpose, and build your community. So with DIY MFA, the whole idea is that you're constantly finding a balance between those three things. When it comes to writing with focus, a lot of the same process-related things relate whether you're writing nonfiction, whether you're writing poetry, whether you're writing fiction. If you're writing memoir, honestly, memoir and fiction kind of behave very similarly. The only difference is that memoirists are somewhat shackled by the reality of the story that they're writing, as opposed to fiction, where you can kind of make things up. But there's still that narrative structure that has to happen. And when it comes to poetry, there's a lot of that fine word level, sentence level work that poets are so great at that you can also, that fiction writers or memoirists or nonfiction writers can benefit from. So it's interesting. We've had a pretty broad scope of genres represented in the course, and also, you know, like genres in terms of like horror versus, you know, fiction, like literary versus romance, but then also poets and memoirists and essayists in the class. And what I found is that having that diversity actually elevates the whole. Like everybody ends up learning from everyone else. When it comes to the reading and the community, kind of the rules all kind of apply the same. I mean, as long as you're writing, you know, you need to read, and choosing what to read and learning to read with a writer's eye, that's kind of, it might be a little different depending on what you're reading, but the same theories apply to all of that. And in terms of building your community, again, the same sort of theoretical approach to building your community applies across the board. The only difference is sort of the nuts and bolts and nitty gritty of how you apply it.
How is the program presently priced?
So the 101 course, we are in the process of rebuilding it, so I can't definitively say what it will be priced when we reopen it. What I can say is whatever we open it at, that will be the lowest price we ever offer it at. In the past, it's been in the sort of $300, $400 range. As the program has evolved, you know, we've sort of shifted the pricing here and there. Again, part of that is because of the you know, the evolution and like the experimentation. What I can say is that I don't foresee this course going into the thousands of dollars range. The whole purpose behind DIY MFA is that it be priced at a level that both honors the fact that people are investing time into this. So, you know, something that kind of makes that, justifies that, but that it also not be so crazy expensive that it kind of puts people off. Like, we don't want it to suddenly be priced at the same as an MFA program, because that would be ridiculous. So I kind of see it being in the somewhere in the hundreds, but it may eventually creep up higher than the 300, 400 range that we were at before we reopen it.
And is that the same pricing for the upper level course?
Right now, I can say Pixels, the platform, is at the $300 range, or $350 or $400. No, $400. Last time we opened it, it was at $399. And that's probably where it'll stay for the time being.
Okay. How do people get more information on the program?
And so the best way to get info, especially if you're interested in courses, is to hop on over to diymfa.com/join, J-O-I-N, and sign up for our newsletter. You'll also be able to tap into all of the, you know, info that's on our website. We have a very extensive blog archive. We also have a lot of podcast episodes, not quite up to the 199 episodes. I think we're at like 150 something, but we have a lot of material there that's all free that you can also access. And when you sign up for the newsletter, you'll also get a free starter kit that kind of introduces you to the DIY MFA philosophy and some of the basic foundational concepts. And the great thing about being on the newsletter is I always announce things first and foremost to our newsletter subscribers, and they always get the best rate. So if we do any like early bird stuff, the newsletter subscribers are the first ones to get access to that.
On the article that I will do on our conversation and post on Facebook and incorporate it into my daily newspaper for about a week, I will include the links to the program and to any of the specific links they just mentioned, if you'll send them to me after the show.
Absolutely.
On the other topic, your article 7 Up in the September Writer's Digest is on methods of enhancing creativity. As the title suggests, you list 7 exercises to aid in this enhancement. Would you take us through these exercises?
Absolutely. So I was super excited when Writer's Digest decided to do a creativity issue, and particularly that they let me do stuff on sort of my nerdy obsession with creativity, because basically all 7 of these items were things that I pulled out of what I call my oracle. So I have this box that sits next to my desk, and I call it my oracle because basically, you know how like back in the ancient Greek days, they would pilgrimage to like the oracle at Delphi to get answers to like their most extreme questions. Well, this is where I go. When I hit the wall and the muse is not cooperating, I go to the oracle and I say, what do you have for me today? And I reach in and I pull something out. So the different things that are inside, these 7 items are kind of different things that I can do with the items that are inside the oracle. So one of them, the first one, is an image file. So I have actually 2 image files in my oracle. One of them is a just little tin box that has a ton of photography from just, you know, when I'm reading like travel magazines or like interesting catalogs that have a really cool photo, I'll just clip the photo out and throw it in that little box. And what I do with these photos is I'll pull them out. If I'm like in need of a, you know, inspiration for something, I'll pull out a picture and I'll just use that and just start writing. In addition to the like random magazine clipping photos, I also, every time I go to a museum, in fact, today I was just at the Guggenheim and I picked up like another 6 or 7 postcards to add to my image file. So I have a whole bunch of postcards. And whenever I look for postcards to put in the image file, I always look for ones that seem to tell a story, like where I look at the picture and there's something mysterious about it, something that makes me think, what if? And so I now have actually quite a large stack, probably close to like 100 postcards in this little box. And so if I need inspiration, I go into my image file and I pull something out, and that usually helps spark a story or spark an idea. Back when I was teaching those workshops, like the live workshops, I would often bring, as like an icebreaker exercise at the beginning of a class, I'd bring a stack of postcards and we'd do an exercise for 5 minutes where we'd write based on a postcard. So that's the first one. And the second one is the character compass, which is a technique that I use. It's really a diagnostic technique. When I've written a whole bunch of stuff, like I've written a scene or a chapter, and I want to get a sense that I've actually made a character come to life on the page. Because oftentimes what happens as writers is we fall into similar patterns and we get stuck in a rut. So I find, for instance, that I'm really good at doing dialogue and action in scenes. I like to write scenes where people are yelling at each other and moving around a lot. I'm not really good at describing what they look like, and I really don't want to get inside anybody's head. I don't know what that says about me. You can psychologize all you like. But so I find that I tend to lean very heavily on action and dialogue. So if I write a scene, I will then sit down and I draw this picture. It's basically a circle, and then I do a vertical line and a horizontal line, kind of like I'm drawing crosshairs. And I label each of those points, like the ends of each of the lines, with TADA for thoughts, actions, dialogue, and appearance. And then I put a dot on each of those axes based on how much of that thing I used in that particular scene. So if I'm writing sort of in my typical Gabriella fashion, usually the A for action will have a dot very close to the edge of the circle because there's a lot of action, and ditto with the dialogue. But then the appearance line will probably, the dot will probably be very close to the center because there's not a lot of that. And the thoughts will also not have a whole lot of that. So when I shade that shape in, when I connect the dots and shade it in, I can see what, like, it's a visual representation of exactly what I'm doing in that scene. Now, a caveat with the character compass, this is not a tool that you use prescriptively as a way to fix your writing. It's simply a diagnostic tool to give you a visual reflection of what you've written. So what I generally like to do is do character compasses for like multiple scenes in a row, and then I can start to see whether I'm still leaning on one particular piece of the character puzzle more than the others. Because let's face it, some scenes, like if your character's sitting alone in a room and there's nothing to look at, there's probably going to be a lot of thought and not a whole lot of anything else. So you can't exactly fault yourself for writing a scene that's heavy on one particular thing if that's what the scene requires. The problem is when you are only leaning on one thing, kind of like using it as a crutch, and you're not actually stretching yourself. So that's the character compass. Then there are a lot of things that were in that article. I think the third one and the fifth one relate to design, because as a designer by trade and training, I tend to rely a lot on design concepts to help me conceptualize what I'm writing. So the third item is color theory, and that's when, like, using elements of color theory, using the relationships between colors to help yourself, help stretch yourself. So one of the things I like to do when I'm working on a project is I'll go to like a paint store and I'll, you know, like Benjamin Moore kind of place, and I'll go and I'll get those little paint chips, and I assign a paint chip to a character. Just like, there's not a whole lot of science to it. It's like the color that I think speaks to that character's personality the best is what I assign to them. And what I found is that when I use my instincts and I kind of instinctively connect a color with a character, first of all, that color can very quickly become a shorthand for the character's personality. So when I'm writing, it becomes almost like a way to remind myself of who this person is just at a glance. I look at the color, I'm like, oh, that person's tomato red. I know what that means about their personality. But then what's really cool that I've discovered is that when you take characters whose colors clash with each other, you put them in a scene together, chances are those characters are going to have, like, sparks will fly. Whereas if the colors tend to go well together, oftentimes those are the characters who play nice with each other. So it's a way for me to very quickly know who to throw together in a scene in order to create the most tension and the most dramatic, you know, whatever, fireworks. The other design element is this idea of negative space, which is, you know, in the design world, when you think about negative space, it's the space around an object as opposed to the object itself. So back when I was in design school, we'd sometimes have to like sketch the space around a, you know, clock and or around a lamp. And then that, you know, the lamp shape would come out based on the, you know, the fact that you drew what was around it. So the same thing is true in a story, right? Like if the story is the object, then the negative space is all that other stuff that exists in the world of your story, but that isn't actually on the page of the story itself. So when you start thinking about what's in the negative space of your story, that can spark ideas that you might never have thought of. So thinking about things like what happens to this character when they walk off stage, as it were, and they go do something that would never end up in the story itself. Sometimes you'll make discoveries about your characters that you never would have realized if you had just been playing within that confined sandbox that is your story. Couple of the other exercises, so I think that's four that we've done so far. One of them is called morphological forced connections, which is basically a fancy word for throwing things that are random together and then making connections. So a great example of this actually is if you go to the DIY MFA website, and there's a thing in the where it says Writer Igniter, or you can just go to writerigniter.com. And basically it's like a slot machine for writers. And the way it works is you press the shuffle button, and then there are four different options: character, situation, object, and setting. And then you hit the shuffle button and it goes, and eventually you'll get a randomized combination of those four things. In design school, we use techniques like this when we had to come up with out-of-the-box solutions to a project. So like, we need to design a product for 5 to 8-year-olds, and we can only use these materials, and we need it to have this theme or whatever. And we'd have these like random things thrown together, and it would force us to come up with something creative and new and very different, because oftentimes as creative people, we get kind of stuck in those same ruts. But with morphological forced connections for writers, it's really about taking those randomized elements of a story and putting them together. And then your brain automatically starts to create connections between those things. And eventually a story comes out of that. And then the last two things are what I call the word box, and then using like word puzzles. So I have a word box. It's like a little tiny container that has a ton of slips of paper in it, and I'm constantly adding new ones. Whenever I find a word that I think is kind of interesting or sounds weird, like putrid. Right now, putrid is a word that just feels interesting to me. I'll put it in that little box. And then whenever I need to write something, I'll pull like 5, 6, 7 words at random. And I force myself, I challenge myself to write something that connects all of those words. Again, it's very similar to the morphological force connections. Like, you have this limited number of options, and then you have to find the connections that join them together. And then in terms of word games, I mean, this was also kind of going with the little color chips. I used to have to try to, I always wanted to have like a handy way to keep track of characters in my stories. And so I was inspired by Lewis Carroll, who would do all these acrostic poems where like the first letter of every line would spell out like a person's name or spell out a code or something like that. And so I started thinking, well, what if you did that with a character's name, and then each line for each letter, you wrote something that described the character. And that became a way for me to have these little shorthand biographies for different characters. When I was working on like my thesis for the MFA, I used that to keep track of the different characters in the story. And again, and then I'd like attach a color chip to it, and boom, like mini bios for all my characters. So I think those are the 7 techniques. But again, it's very much the theme that connects it all is kind of applying the nerdy design stuff to the writing.
Very similar to the word box. I've been the poetry workshop, and one of the poets has an exercise where you take the book off your shelf, and you write and turn to page 136 or page 258 or whatever, and you write a poem using only the words on that page. And she, for instance, had one that she did from the page in the bell jar, and she said that it forces you to use words that you might not normally even think to use. I think that's fairly interesting as an exercise.
Absolutely. And then like me being the math nerd, occasionally I'll be like, okay, let me go open a book to a random page, and then I'll do like the Fibonacci sequence, and I'll circle the first word and then the next word and then 2 words after that, and then 3, you know, and then you go circling words according to like Fibonacci numbers or according to some other random, like the digits of the number pi or something. And that'll give you a very randomized selection of words that then you have to turn into a poem or into a story or something like that.
In September, you'll speak at the IBOND conference, and you'll share the spotlight with some very well-known women. Please tell us about the conference and about the women.
So this was kind of an exciting thing. I am speaking at INBOUND, which is at the end of September. I'm giving one of the breakout sessions, and I'll be talking on a topic that has become very near and dear to me, to my heart. I've been branching out a bit from the writing and focusing on speaking about creativity in general. In fact, the article in the Writer's Digest was sort of a great springboard to move into that. And so so that's what I'll be speaking on. My talk is How to Survive and Succeed as a Designer Without Breaking Your Heart or Losing Your Mind. And the idea is that as a creative person, we have our creativity resides in 2 different parts of us. There's the part that resides in our brain, but then there's also the part that's in our hearts. And how do we reconcile? Because the two often are at odds with each other. Sometimes we try to reason our way through a creative problem when really it's a more heart-centered problem and we need to be focusing on the heart side of things, or vice versa. And so that's what the talk is going to be about, is sort of learning to find a way to reconcile those 2 things. And the 3 amazing women who happen to be 3 of my heroes of sorts are Brené Brown, who is the author of Rising Strong and Daring Greatly, and she's a psychologist, a researcher, really, really smart, smart woman. Elizabeth Gilbert, obviously we all know who she is, the author of Big Magic and Eat, Pray, Love. And then, of course, Michelle Obama. So I just about lost my mind when I found out that I was speaking at this conference and that these 3 amazing women are going to be the keynotes. So I'm a little terrified that I might just turn into a squealing fangirl at some point.
I had two conference stories that reminded me of. One was I was the lead person on the panel at the Mac Expo in Boston years ago, and it was the early days of the Macintosh, and the conference we had people there showing different presentation things that they were doing on my panel. There was Bonnie McBurb, who's now the novelist writing about Sherlock Holmes. She's in her second Holmes book out. A professor from Dartmouth and someone else. And at that time, Bonnie handled all the presentation to John Sculley, who was the Apple CEO. And we had this, what I thought was an interesting panel, but we're in the Heinz Auditorium in Boston, and we had a good 500 people in the audience. And I said, boy, this is wonderful. All these people came to see us and all this, and this is great. Then after our panel ended, which was the last on the venue, Bonnie's husband, Alan Kay, who was the hero in the computer industry, came to the panel with Bill Gates. They had been on the previous panel, and obviously they were the ones who brought the audience, and the people just hung around for us, you know. Then, so the balloon broke. Then another time, in 1984, I was part of an anthology, Digital Deli, that was way ahead of its time. It had articles on the way the technology was changing everything, and it was put together by the luncheon group that we had in New York City. And part of the people they were technology people, like Gates and Steve Wozniak, who co-founded Apple and others. But we also had people from other things, like William F. Buckley, Henny Youngman, Ray Bradbury, all these different authors talking about how they used computers. And it was a wonderful experience, and there was no publicity for the book, and we probably sold about 100 copies. They wouldn't have sold all that we did. Professor Dyson, who ran conferences, didn't order one for everyone who came to a conference. Well, about 30 years later or more, my son, who's a television writer and a game developer, was on the panel at San Diego Comic Con, and the keynote speaker was Ray Bradbury. So it all came together. It was like this big circle, I guess. So I thought that was interesting.
That's awesome. I have to say, like, Comic-Con is like my nerdy dream. Like, that would be like my nerdy version of the Holy Grail. Like, I would love to speak at Comic-Con.
Well, he used to go to most of them in San Diego. What's next for you?
Well, we are gearing up to launch Pixels the Platform again sometime in the early fall, and then a little later in the fall, hopefully, fingers crossed, if all goes well, we'll be reopening 101. And then what else is next? Inbound is pretty big, and I just found out that I will be giving a TEDx talk later this fall. So more details on that to come soon. But yeah, that's kind of what the big one that I'm excited about.
We've covered a good deal of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
Well, there is a DIY MFA book. So if you want to get kind of the nuts and bolts of what it's about, that's probably the most compact way to do it. I mean, a lot of that, you'll find a lot of information on the website, but this is sort of the most compressed way to learn more about that. So that's what I would add. And yeah, and we have some really amazing guests coming up on our podcast too. So now is a good time to subscribe if you wanted to hear from some really awesome authors.
Well, thank you very much, Gabrielle. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so, so much for having me. This was a blast. I love chatting with you.
Yes, well, we'll do it again when you're up to 15 years in a business, hopefully. A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com, and and published a daily newsletter mentioned earlier. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. But I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with Kate Hansen-Foster, and every week after that at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And let's go off for Count Basie tonight.
Thanks again, Gabriella.
Thank you.
And good night, everybody. Bye. 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 Bye.